Jessica, welcome to Seize and Desist podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me here, Aidan. I'm happy to chat about the seizing and desisting.
Well, exactly. And fun fact, the show was named Seize and Desist because we were helping a government agency in getting ready to potentially sell a very large, expensive, sanctioned asset. And your fraternity of lawyers internationally, a particular law firm that will not be named, sent us a very aggressive cease and desist just for being involved in the potential procurement process. And that day we were literally talking about our own podcast. So we named the podcast Cease and Desist after a cease and desist letter that I got one Friday evening. So that's the aside. The background to this is obviously, Jessica, you and I met at Asset Recovery International a couple of years ago. We were just talking about a very snowy February in Dublin. And anyone that listens to the podcast will also know that we talk regularly about asset recovery as a sector has all of these challenges because it's so poorly described and defined. I mean, Asset Recovery International is a large conference that features no law enforcement whatsoever, no corruption cases whatsoever. It's very much from the legal sector. AssetRecovery.com is a website that recovers IT devices and like memory analysis of IT. And it's something that we'll definitely sort of dive into in asset recovery. And then I was speaking to people like Stephen Sargent and others saying, we need to get more Canadian perspectives. And then he came back to me and went, you got to speak to Jessica. So we've had a few friends of Canada. So a warm welcome to you. Can you give us a bit of an introduction into who you are, what you do, and why on earth you're talking to me today and taking time out of your precious day to talk about asset recovery?
Absolutely. Well, as Stephen Sargent, who is wonderful and made the connection for this podcast, that's reason number one. But in terms of who I am and why I'm talking to you about seizing assets and asset recovery is I'm a Canadian lawyer, a commercial litigator, and the majority of my practice, it deals with digital assets. So that work includes work for exchanges, like internal investigations when something's gone very wrong. It could be with an employee. There could be a cybersecurity breach that we're involved in investigating, or some of the recovery or litigation that might come from that. But the bigger part of what I do is I help individuals or groups of investors with recovering their digital assets. This could be when digital assets or cryptocurrency is stolen from a smart contract being exploited. It can be investment scams. I have some meme coin price manipulation cases too. Wow. And then you just have the more traditional frauds and conspiracies. I've got one right now that's come out of an investment in a cryptocurrency mining business. And so we've dealt with the recovery and seizure of a whole bunch of cryptocurrency mining machines. And I just love this work. It sounds incredibly nerdy to say, but I think there's nothing more interesting than unraveling a fraud case, following the money, the evidence through, and working with fraud in the cryptocurrency space. There is just so much of that evidence that you could just find online. You can explore yourself without getting production of documents, without getting a warrant, without getting anything. It's just available. And I really love being able to do that work to help people recover.
Well, actually, so you've already made me change my mind on what I was going to ask you next, which is proof of how purposely unprepared I am, because I like just having conversations with people. And I was going to ask you about some of those interesting cases, because I like the fact that we're already talking about, you know, they're not crypto cases, this hotly debated topic from Nick Furnow's book, and Alison Jimenez, fabulous guest, a couple of months back. And Alison did the whole takedown of Nick's book in a nice way. And obviously I like both people, so I'm sitting in the middle. But it was tongue in cheek about the fact that, well, there actually is crypto crime in the sense of there are these unique, never seen before crime types at scales we've never seen before involving digital assets. And on the other side, Nick's point is the fact that you don't want to pigeonhole and have a crypto person and thinking of these things as just, it's a crypto case, because as you've mentioned, like, they're fraud cases, but they involve this new asset. And if it's a mining scam, is there actual crypto involved, or is it the promise of future returns? We've, the OneCoin case, the most famous missing crypto coin case, but there was actually no crypto in the case. It was all a big scam. But rather than go into the cases, you just mentioned about, what you can do online and what you can look and what you can search. I get the impression from our conversations that you're interested in sort of rolling your sleeves up and getting involved in the cases. And one of the big things we try and solve on this podcast is hearing from practitioners with different perspectives that work on asset recovery cases. So what has your journey been into this, and what gave you that interest in actually getting involved? And I imagine, I mean, this isn't something you've just started doing the last couple of weeks and decided to do some crypto cases. Could you give us a little bit about your actual personal background? Are you a secret computer scientist major and you've been mining on your own laptop for the last 5 or 6 years back in the day? Or what brought you to being interested in these types of cases? Because I know some other people run for the hills when they see, you know, crypto case in the private sector, and it's just not their thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So for a long time in my career, I've been doing fraud work. And as you say, crypto is just another type of asset that can be stolen and it could be recovered. And I used to practice in Vancouver. And so in Vancouver, I did a lot of real estate related fraud cases. A lot of that coming from the fact that the Vancouver real estate market just skyrocketed around 2012 to 2014. There was these huge increases in the values of property. And so there was a ton of litigation in the sale of homes where someone would sell, the contract would be assigned to another buyer, and it would get assigned again, and it would assigned again. And of course, person selling their home who sees their house get sold for possibly millions more than they sold it for to a fourth person down the line thinks that this is a fraud and a conspiracy, and a whole bunch of litigation ensues with the realtors, the lawyers, and the purchasers, and the number of people who are involved in the assignments and the sales. So that was sort of how I got my foot into fraud and conspiracy-related litigation. And then around the same time, also still in Vancouver, there was Gerald Cotton operating Quadriga CX.
One of the first cases we ever got involved with, yeah.
Yeah. And my firm has a small slice of litigation involving that. But at the time, I went down the rabbit hole. I thought that everything to do with Gerald Cotton, with Patrin, all of the details were so interesting. And so after I moved back to Toronto years ago, that's what led me over to focusing so much on fraud in the digital asset space, not just in the real estate context. I did a bunch with traditional financial institutions, but really moving over more to this sadly growing area of digital asset fraud.
And it's one of those, look, for those that don't know, I mean, I remember those early, it was Quadriga was the corporate entity, wasn't it, in the Cotton case. I remember like some of our earliest slides, you know, a lot of the work we do is like education for law enforcement and for practitioners about this space. And remember was he dead? At one point, there was even a whole theory that he'd possibly faked his own life because the assets had moved. And I remember this, I think he was in India or in Goa somewhere, and people were trying to get copies of the death certificate and then they couldn't be found, and trying to just wade through what was conspiracy theory, what was truth, what was not. But as you said, fundamentally, there was a case. There was people giving someone assets on a future promise, thinking those assets were being treated in a particular way. And there was a result of a financial loss. So it kind of doesn't matter if it's a Ponzi scheme or it's crypto, it's just fraud. But on the more technical aspects, what got you into that position? And I should say, for the avoidance of doubt, I mean, these podcasts are entirely agnostic. I mean, these aren't PR pitches going, oh my God, Jessica, you're so amazing. Talk to us why you do great work at your firm. We just talk to practitioners about what their backgrounds are in this space. What got you into that? Right, I actually want to be able to look on a blockchain. I want to be able to try and trace some of these things myself, like knowing where your limits are. I mean, how did you sort of get into that? What was your sort of first, like, what was your first foray into, you know, having to look on a blockchain?
Yeah, I think it comes from the fact that as litigators, we dive into whatever the subject matter is. So regardless of what you're about, like, I have a political science degree. I'm not an expert in any of these areas, but whether you're dealing with a real estate case, if you're dealing with a construction dispute, whatever it is, you dive in and you need to
You got to figure out as much as you can, as quickly as you can.
Exactly. And so when I was doing a lot of financial crime related litigation with banks, I read a huge number of financial records. A lot of times I was saying, we need a forensic accountant. And ultimately, that's usually where we go. But before we can go to an expert to review something, we need to understand it. And so I was used to diving into to all these financial records. And so it was only the natural thing when I started doing crypto work that, well, you gave me a transaction hash. I'm going to go on an open blockchain explorer. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to see where it goes. I'm going to see if we can follow it through. And of course, we work with lots of great partners who do tracing work. And eventually, you know, they tell us this has been traced through. It's hidden exchange. It's a black box. We need to get a court order for production of the KYC and the transaction data at that point. But if there is evidence available online, like I'm going to look at both the transaction data and I'm going to also do my own OSINT research. Like if there is information about my defendants, it's out there. We look at that. We use really whatever we can find as part of understanding your case.
Yeah. And I think that's it. There is such a big misconception about just how open source all of this is. I mean, even people get themselves tied up in knots about like no jurisdiction and where is the blockchain? And you know, I'm sure you've seen more times than me sort of judges and people asking for, well, you know, who is this Satoshi Nakamoto? Thinking about some of the early cases that really went into the weeds of explaining what the blockchain is and things like that. Do you think we're getting over a lot of those challenges? Do you see, and obviously maybe just sticking with, you know, Canada specifically at the moment, like what is that experience from a, you know, a victim coming in and saying, hey, we've got a case, I've lost my assets, I want to appoint someone to help me. Maybe law enforcement didn't have the resources or the capacity, or it just wasn't a case that law enforcement could adopt. Maybe walk us through what that journey currently looks like for, like, from the victim's perspective and how you see it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot, we sadly have a lot of victims of different frauds that involve cryptocurrency in some way reaching out. The investment scams is a big one, but also people who thought they were investing or sending money for something else and they just happened to make the payment through crypto. So two different, one being like a true crypto related fraud, and then others where it's just how you paid money into a scam. And we always, that's question one, like, let me understand what type of fraud this is. What do you know about potential defendants? Is there a connection to Canada? Is there some way in which we could bring this to an Ontario court and say that there's jurisdiction for the court to hear it? Now, that's a fairly low bar. We can have the victim can be located here. Sometimes we're contacted by people who are in other countries. We could have the exchange where they trace through their digital assets. And, and this is part of what we ask. Have you had someone trace them? Have you traced? Do you know where they went? And we get them involved with a tracing company if they haven't done that already. And if an exchange is identified and the exchange is registered, and regulated here in Canada, that's a good sign that we can also proceed here, bringing it to the courts in Ontario. And then we start to look at the amount that is in dispute. And while we understand that very small losses from a litigation perspective can be very significant to victims, there still has to be a bit of a cost-benefit analysis for them. You know, is this worth for you to spend more money chasing when there may or may not be a good chance of recovery? And good chances of recovery depend, are there assets that are still on chain that we can see that are sitting there? Are we going to find any assets that are with a custodial exchange that could be recovered? And do we think that there's a defendant who's going to be in a jurisdiction where we could recover against them? Or do we think the people involved might be victims themselves that are in some sort of encampment in a country being held against their will, exploiting people, and it's gone to organized crime? So there's a whole bunch of different factors that weigh into whether it makes sense to get involved.
And I guess that is one of the most, you know, difficult conversations, you know, to have with someone when someone's lost $50,000, $100,000, you know, life-changing amount of money, but to say it's probably not, you know, you're probably not best advised, no spending, no throwing good money after bad, as we would use this, the very sort of brutal definition. And we try and, I remember someone sort of saying to me previously, using the example of if you had an expensive watch or a, you know, $30,000 Rolex or a, you know, ludicrously expensive handbag in, you know, Piccadilly Circus in London, and someone snatched it and ran off. I mean, realistically, what are the chances that you're ever going to see that item again? Or are you going to pay, you know, ex-special forces operators and private investigators to try and comb through CCTV and find people? And I think it's probably more brutal in crypto because a lot of times you can see things on chain and there is that sense of, but I can see it and I can see stuff. You know, I almost feel that it becomes a lost cause much quicker in physical assets than digital assets. And then people hanging around then means that you have this chance of like re-victimization. Is that something you've seen a lot in Canada where you have, we see a lot of it in the UK, where people go looking for help. They maybe don't hit that threshold or that barrier and then they end up falling for a secondary scam or they're actually specifically targeted because they're looking for help in recovering their assets.
Absolutely. And that's something that really, it's so sad to see. I have a lot of people who contact me and they describe the circumstances of what's going on. And what becomes clear is not only were they the victim of a first scam, but now they've given significant amounts of money, sometimes exceeding what they put into the original scam to recovery scammers. And it follows a pattern. You know, they say, I got a WhatsApp message. Someone said that they had an investment plan for me. We started messaging on Discord. I sent all this crypto through an exchange. They kept telling me there was a fee to recover it. Then this guy from this department contacted me, said I had to pay this tax. It was being seized. I had to get it released. Then another guy contacted me and he said that he could help me recover it. He was a hacker. He was going to get my money out. And so it follows these patterns. And so at a minimum, if I talk to someone and I don't think that there's a chance that or a good chance that we can help or it might not make sense for them to spend more money, I try to do the education piece of explaining the way these scams work. Mm-hmm. Because the last thing I want is someone to leave and continue to fall victim to these kinds of these predatory behaviors from probably the same scammers who are just pretending to be different people.
Yeah, because usually they're the ones that have access to their information in the first instance and they can just sort of reframe why they're getting in touch. And I think maybe our second or third guest on this podcast, you know, was Aaron West. And we work very closely and know a lot of our clients are, you know, Operation Shamrock members, for example. Mm-hmm. So you get to hear these like, you know, these brutal tales from the front. It doesn't seem to be getting any better. I mean, we're years down the line, and I don't know whether that's because there is just a continual tsunami of new cases coming in. So it's not like there was an initial hump of cases and it's getting better. It seems to be that the methodologies for extraction are getting more advanced. More people are getting online, you know, continually seeing, as in more people are holding crypto assets because of the constant rising value of crypto portfolios as well. I mean, from the first, like zoning in on the Canadian perspective, I can obviously make a ton of assumptions from a UK former law enforcement and investigative background, just to give people some context and hear it straight from the right person's mouth. I mean, what is the current sort of methodologies in Canada from a victim's perspective? Is it the same route of going down that, you know, whether if law enforcement adopt the case, you could go down a civil recovery mechanism? Can you as a law firm then use the same? Or is there anything unique or different in the sort of legislative toolkit in Canada that people should be aware of that's very different than everywhere else?
I think the Canadian framework is quite similar to the UK. Law here, it follows along. So, for example, and I think these exist in the UK as well, the primary tools from a civil recovery standpoint, what we can go to court and obtain would be a Mareva injunction, mm-hmm. so a freezing yeah. order, freezing if we can see with a custodial wallet that there are still assets there, we can get an order to freeze those if we can show that they were traced from the victim. We can get an order to freeze if we know a defendant. We say, if we believe that this person has accounts with this exchange, freeze all of his accounts. We don't know what the addresses are, just freeze the account, all of the wallets associated, all of the addresses. Then we have a Norwich order. And a Norwich order, this sometimes is an intermediate step we use where we can get an order to produce information often from custodial exchanges. So if they have transaction data that we can't see once it's gone into that black box, we can get production to trace through. And that can show you where digital assets ended and ended up and whether there's somewhere on chain or somewhere that could be recovered. They can show us the KYC information, help us identify a defendant. And I have had recently in a case where we had a defendant. We had sued the defendant. We got production of the KYC from an exchange for these accounts that we believed to have been controlled by the defendant. And the KYC showed it was them. So, and that's an individual located here in Ontario. And so,
oh, wow.
A
KYC fraudster. Whoa.
Yeah. Well, and there were multiple layers. Yeah. At first, there was no KYC, and we had to push under the court order to say, well, no, you must have KYC. We know you have it somewhere. And there was a variety of sub accounts before they managed to connect it. And I think the exchange may have had trouble actually connecting it themselves. But ultimately, it means that there's a defendant who's been identified, and then assets that they have here, separate from crypto assets, where you can trace through the plaintiff or the victim's money, those are potentially open to being recovered in the litigation as well, or to being claimed against. So it does open up other possibilities. And then the third sort of recovery mechanism that we have in the civil court, which again, I think is similar to what's possible in many other common law jurisdictions, is an Anton Piller order, a civil search and seizure order, where this one comes up if we know that they have cold storage. We know there's a hard drive sitting in their house. We know who they are. Unique situation where you will know who a defendant is, where their home is. Someone could dox themselves. You can get this information.
It's not unusual. We've seen it a lot. We've seen where we've had like no fraudulent, no divorce cases, and we've had things like that where business partners put in assets beyond reach of people, and it's like, I know he has it. We've done it. We've done some tracing. We've seen that there's been maybe an analytic company's been able to provide IP attribution. And it's like, we thought it was the guy in the building at the bottom of the road, and guess which wallet accessed it? A brand new wallet at the building at the bottom of the road has accessed this in the last 30 days. And like, so it definitely does happen.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. It can also be like, if I've got a meme case where, you know, they might know where something is. So there's...
For those that don't know, what is a meme case?
Meme coins are supposed to be, they're not supposed to be financial assets. It's a cryptocurrency or a digital coin.
As in this person has launched the meme coin. They're the owners of the scheme, do you mean? And then when you say meme coin case?
There's a couple different ones that I have, okay, and they follow. So it could be starting their own meme coin intended to be a collectible. Mm-hmm. It can also be people who invested heavily into a meme coin. Again, intended to be a collectible and not a financial asset.
Yeah.
So that follows more into a different category for recovery. If it's not a financial asset, seeking to recover damages becomes problematic. It's a thing. It's a thing you might say is my property and belongs to me. It might be recoverable.
It's a gold bar or a trading card for all intents and purposes.
Exactly.
Versus being a financial instrument. Yeah.
Exactly. More like getting jewelry out of the safety deposit box. So it's more analogous in that sense. But the Anton Piller route allows you, if you know that there's cold storage, you believe there's a computer or a hard drive sitting there, then you can get a search and seizure order. And that's more similar to the criminal route of what the police can do if they go and get an order for search and seizure. Like in Canada, just now in Quebec, the RCMP seized $56 million
Perfect segue. I was going to ask you, because like I said, one of the things that we're having this Canadian conversation is that, I mean, we have the pleasure of working with RCMP and working with some regulators, and they seem to be turning the dial up to 11 at the moment.
Absolutely. I think that the Canadian RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, mm-hmm, that is, they've got some very sophisticated teams. This is the largest seizure really that they've done. They've shut down an entire platform. This, of course, is at the stage where it's under an investigatory warrant. So there's no conviction. There's no proof of the allegations, but they certainly are going after more and more crypto-related scams and organized crime in this space. There is still a lot of victims who I think are having trouble in getting police to investigate. We hear from a lot of people who want to go the civil route because the police aren't necessarily able to go after each and one of these cases, but certainly where there's high value, a lot of victims, vulnerable victims, I think that they're really trying to step in and turn up the volume.
And just back on the point, just because I know the practitioners listening will be interested on your perspective, when you were describing the tracing where you're maybe hitting the exchange, you can serve a production order on that exchange. What's been your experiences when it is one of the non-responsive international exchanges that are in a jurisdiction that has zero regulatory framework? Is that a case of kind of nothing you can do in that instance bar, you know, send multiple requests? But is it right to assume that even if the trail goes cold over there, but you can find a house or a property or other assets, even if the digital asset trail goes cold, but you still got evidence that you've been defrauded, can you still go after the person's other assets that you can find around the world as well? Because I've heard many people say, oh, we've lost the trail of the assets. It's like, but he still has a house. He still has, you maybe have a suspect. How does that sort of play out in those cases where you just hit an absolute dead end on the exchange route?
When you hit a dead end, there's two different ways. So the way you can recover against other assets is if you can show, you can trace your money through. So you say, from my bank account, I bought X number of Bitcoin, I transferred it here, I can follow it on the blockchain, it goes cold. Probably isn't Bitcoin, they're probably using another coin, but at any rate, once it goes cold, you aren't able to trace it to a specific asset. So if you can see them offboard cryptocurrency, and then the next day they go out and purchase a boat, there's a good inference that you can be arguing to the court, they used my crypto to buy that asset. I have an entitlement or I have an equitable interest in that asset. That's different from saying, they defrauded me. They took this much money from me. I want a judgment for my damages for what I've lost, and then enforcing that judgment against their assets and what they have to recover against. So there are two different routes. One where you're saying, I have an interest in this particular property versus I have a judgment and you should enforce it against what they owe.
That's useful. And I think we've seen success with that, the almost that conversion and that equitable interest, because the most common thing, very rarely now do we see assets remaining stationary. I mean, it usually is hits an exchange, hits somewhere else, gets converted, gets swapped, gets moved into other assets. And we're now seeing with the maturity in the market, just anecdotally hearing from our law enforcement partners, you know, things like being put into other types of adjacent funds. They're being put into, sort of money funds where they're actually generating yield, because even fraudsters, especially the big organized scams, want to make money off the assets that they're sitting on. So we're just seeing it getting more and more sort of complicated. I know we don't have a massive amount of time because you have a hard stop, because I kept changing the slot for this particular podcast. What do you think? I want to touch on two things. You had a couple of brilliant blog posts that we've shared with other people before in the past about CODA's law. And it's such a hot topic and it's such a divisive topic. We could have a separate podcast on it alone. Don't get me started on sort of mixers and things like that, but I would love to just get your views on that, and then also what you think are some of the big challenges and what we're expecting, or if you're predicting over the next sort of year or so, what do you think are going to be some of the changes that are going to potentially affect sort of asset recovery outcomes? And you can take those in any order you see fit.
Let's start with the CODA's law topic, a topic I love to talk about. I get it from both perspectives. I'm obviously on one side, but I get the opposite view that if the code allows me to do this, I can do it. If the smart contract lets me extract these tokens from the liquidity pool, then I am entitled to do that. This is just smart strategy on my part. Sorry, sucks to be you. Like, that's the general gist of it. But I think of it more analogously to Canadian tax law. And Canadian taxpayers are generally, and this isn't advice to the listeners, it's just
this is not legal advice. This is not legal or financial advice.
But they're generally entitled to arrange their affairs to minimize paying tax. And they're allowed to work to try to do that. Mm. Ultimately, I think when someone is trying to misuse the system, our Income Tax Act has an additional provision that says that if you're trying to use the sections to abuse the object and spirit of the law, well, that isn't allowed, even though you're allowed to arrange them. I think if the code is law, argument is the same. Well, you might be able to do that. You might be able to extract coins from a liquidity pool or take funds in some other way. But ultimately, is that really the object and purpose of that protocol, of that smart contract? And I think the answer is no, and that there needs to be some sort of law that would prevent you from purposefully misusing a protocol. I don't think that law specifically exists.
Yeah.
But in the civil recovery sense, we can still proceed against those types of actions.
But it is, and it is, like, I think we'll absolutely have to do a part two on this, because I know some people will be grinding their teeth right now and other people will be going, yay. And it's such a big topic. I mean, I think of it as, like, when we've seen, like, you know, the code is law defense being used, like, no, you don't shut down, no, you don't arrest the guy who created the email protocol. I think, yeah, but there's a difference between creating a piece of technology that's used in illicit behavior than running the front end of a piece of technology that you're personally profiting from and you know you're evading sanctions, for example. And I think that the code is law part is an interesting in between, because if, like you say, there's a vulnerability and you exploit that, I understand the, like, tax avoidance and tax evasion as a former tax inspector. I mean, tax avoidance morally is a different conversation, but you're not breaking the law. And especially if you declare the scheme, you know, HMRC will look at it. They'll maybe try and modify it or shut it down. But tax avoidance is planning. Tax evasion is illegal. And there's that clear. But then there's the middle about, but is it the right thing to do? I mean, if like the little old lady or the little old man that has no cash falling out of their pocket at the bus stop, is it illegal if you just walk behind them and take it all and go, huh? And I walked off. Is that actual theft? And I guess that's what I love about this space, is the very non-crypto parallels that will be drawn in all of these cases when we try and then something will happen and then it'll be baked in and it'll become the stated case that everyone talks about, or it'll become the legal precedent. And we probably thought we were heading in a certain direction until US elections dictated a very different attitude to a lot of these things. And I think that definitely will be for a separate podcast. But we will include there's a couple of great blog posts that we'll include in the show notes to this, because I know there's just so much more we could unpack about the code is law. What do you think of the future gazing, if I can get you, before we sort of wrap up? Or what do you think are what are you screaming from the sort of the sermon that you think is going to be the big things that's going to be happening in the space over the year? Or what's the big lessons learned that you're like, if you're in my shoes doing this for the first time, please don't do it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see what is to come in the United States. On the CODIS law in particular, there was a big decision that happened earlier in the year with the Mango Markets exploit that seemed to be a decider in whether exploiting a smart contract and using the code as it allowed you to could be criminal conduct. There's a whole bunch of that's sort of come up, and it's maybe not as decided as it was a few months ago. And there's a lot changing in the U.S. So I'm interested to see how that plays out, because there has been so much regulatory enforcement and so many fraud cases, especially in the CODIS, with the CODIS law debate, that have been prosecuted in the States. And so depending how that shakes out, it could be really interesting from not just from a Canadian law perspective, but just the industry more generally.
Well, look, I think I'm going to hold you to the fact that I think we need to do a part two on sort of CODIS law, on mixers, on all of these things. Because I think, as you say, and we'll maybe do a bit of a special, because there's so many different avenues and, you know, different judgments and different decisions will just fundamentally change things. One of the questions I was asked recently by law enforcement was, well, what if we reverse engineer a sort of smart contract to seize assets, for example? And if we identify a vulnerability, do you actually need a court order to do that? Because as you're, to your point, it's like, it's kind of like it was left in the middle of the street. Do I need a court order is very different than me entering a password into someone's computer and accessing something and taking it. So there's all of these really interesting procedural things that we're going to see in digital asset recovery that haven't traditionally existed before. So Jessica, thank you so much for joining us. I definitely want to continue this conversation, and we'll enclose in the, like I say, in the show notes the different blog posts that you'd mentioned, and I think this is where we'll pick things up when we go again for a round two. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Aidan, and I would love to continue this conversation.
We definitely will.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.